From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In 2007, Des Moines resident Jerry Campbell lost his brother to suicide. Now Jerry's a member of a support group in Polk County, open to anyone dealing with the loss of a loved one to suicide. This hour, to mark National Suicide Prevention Week, we talk with Jerry Campbell about how he's coping with his brother's suicide and look at suicide prevention efforts in Iowa. We'll also talk with Dale Schell, the Youth Suicide Prevention Coordinator at the Iowa Department of Health, and Crisis Intervention Program Coordinator John Sheen. Has suicide or attempted suicide touched your family? Join our discussion about suicide prevention following this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Every 15 minutes in the United States, a person takes his or her own life. An attempted suicide is estimated to be made once every minute. Over 34,000 people in the United States die by suicide every year. This hour, to mark National Suicide Prevention Week, we look at suicide prevention efforts in Iowa. And we're joined, first of all, by Jerry Campbell. He's a Des Moines resident who lost his brother, Dusty, to suicide in 2007. Jerry Campbell, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines, Dale Schell. He is the Youth Suicide Prevention Coordinator at the Iowa Department of Public Health. Dale Schell, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I want to focus, ask Jerry, first of all, of course, very sorry for the loss of your brother, Dusty. Jerry, thank you for stepping forward to tell your story so that we can also help raise awareness about suicide and to help in its prevention. We want to talk to you about your involvement with the Suicide Survivor Support Group in that area, but could you start us off by telling us a little bit about the circumstances surrounding your brother's death in 2007?
My brother died of suicide from overdose of insulin. We're not sure how many units he shot up, but we're estimating about 200 units of insulin. And it took several hours for him to pass away, which we were told by the medical examiner, which in some ways is a relief, but other ways it hurts more knowing the fact that he could have picked up the phone and called for help anytime he wanted.
Mm-hmm. He left a suicide note.
Yes, he did.
Do you feel comfortable sharing any part of that with us?
I didn't bring it with me, but my brother actually planned this suicide for over 1 week, and we know that because of what he wrote in the note. And when he was found, he had laid out items that he wanted to go to specific people on little tables around him, and he had got all of his ducks in a row all the previous 2 weeks. So we know for a fact for that. And the one thing that was kind of comforting but also disheartening was, you know, he basically said don't hate him for doing what he was doing because he loved us so much.
Mm-hmm. How did you hear the news?
I received a phone call from my mother when I was at work.
Was there any warning, any reason to believe? You said he'd been planning this, you found out afterwards, for a week. Any reason to believe that anybody got any idea of his plans in your family, friend?
No. Nobody had the slightest inkling that he was going to commit suicide. In fact, his pastor had spoken with him on the Thursday before he died of suicide.
He was not sharing his depressed feelings with anyone?
No, because he and I had actually made plans. He was going to move up to Des Moines and start living with me.
Mm-hmm. What do you understand about his mindset that led to the suicide? Where was he in his head?
Well, he had lost his wife approximately 2 weeks before he died of suicide, and he watched her die in the hospital. She had had a stroke in the cerebral cortex, so it took her about 3 weeks to pass away, and he had myasthenia gravis, which is a type of muscular dystrophy, and he was actually just wasting away. He had gone from a very strong person to a man that couldn't even lift a card table, and it's my belief, and I truly believe this with all my heart, that the reason he died of suicide was he didn't want our family to have to watch him die and suffer like that.
I understand that Dusty's best friend in Nevada committed suicide the following month.
No, that was my best friend.
And your best, I'm sorry.
That was Daryl Winter, and that was 22 days later.
Are they in any way linked, the news?
No.
Okay.
No, not at all.
Tell us about the shock and grief that you experienced. What do you remember about the days for you and your family immediately following your brother's suicide?
Well, one of the things that, and I'm not trying to put down law enforcement, but they just came over to my mom and dad's house, and they brought the people that actually found my brother, his stepson and his girlfriend found my brother, and so they just brought him over to my mother and father's house. They walked in and said, "Your son's dead," and then they left. So they left my family and all the other people there completely alone. When I received the phone call, I just jumped in my truck and I drove down to Fairfield. And one of the problems we had there was because the first thing my mother asked me, she wanted me to find Dusty. So I went out to the hospital because they had informed us they were taking him to the hospital. I got out there. The people at the hospital were very uncooperative when I told them I wanted to know what was going on with my brother.
This is which hospital?
Jefferson County Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually threatened physical violence against several people. And when you start making a stand like that, then they start talking to you.
Was Dusty still alive at this point?
No, he'd been declared dead at the house. Or, excuse me, he'd been declared dead at the hospital.
So this was your aim to find Dusty's body, and that's where the problems were.
Correct. And they weren't very forthcoming with information, so I finally got the information. They told me he was being brought to Des Moines, Ankeny for the state medical examiner because he had died under not natural causes.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in time, they informed me that Fred Beener, who is the funeral director down there and a very nice man, and I'm not meaning to put a plug in for Fred and his funeral home, but Fred Beener's the one that actually helped us the most. I contacted Fred on the phone and he explained to me the entire situation. So here's a private citizen, even though he's a businessman, giving us more information and more support than we got from anybody down there in that area.
So your problem is with the level of support you got from the county, the local authorities.
Correct. And the information and the way they gave us the information.
How did neighbors and friends, people in your community, react after this?
All the neighbors started coming over immediately to my mom and dad's house and everybody down there, my mom's church. Everybody supported my family tremendously.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell if there was a difference in the way this support was shown from a natural death or a homicide compared to a suicide?
No, because we had lost my sister in 2006 and the people down there were very comforting to us. And then when we lost Joanne, my brother's wife, the neighbors and everybody were very comforting. And it's kind of like the people that are close to our family and our family, a death is a death. We didn't, mm-hmm. even though we still talk about it being a suicide, that's not a stigma with us.
I guess that's what I'm getting at exactly, is to what degree you experienced a stigma that is attached with suicide in this case.
With our family and community, it was very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a lot of help because we didn't have people talking behind our back or pointing fingers at us. They were just sorry for our loss.
Sharing the grief with you.
Absolutely.
Jerry Campbell, a Des Moines resident, lost his brother to suicide in 2007. He's good enough to share that experience with us now as we mark Suicide Prevention Week. Dale Chell with us, Youth Suicide Prevention Coordinator at the Iowa Department of Public Health, also in our Des Moines studio. Dale Chell, when you hear Jerry's story, I know you're a youth suicide prevention coordinator, but when you hear Jerry's story, how does it fit in, Dusty, with or not fit in with state statistics on suicide?
Well, I think what we do know statistically is that more males are likely to die of suicide. What you hear with Jerry's story is similar in many ways for other people, but everybody has their own story of how they've lost a loved one, a friend, a coworker, and each one responds differently to the grief, and they actually have different experiences with how they're responded to by other people in terms of stigma and judgment and so on. So there's you know, the suicide is such a tragic loss because it has so many other different components to it.
Mm-hmm. What are the age groups that are more likely to commit suicide?
Well, this is nationally, and of course it fits with Iowa as well. But in addition to being more likely to have males die of suicide, which is about 75 to 80% of suicide deaths, we tend to see the more middle-aged, actually, in the 35 to 55-year-old range is where you have the highest rates of suicide.
The explanation for that?
Well, there's no easy explanation. That's what we've been trying to figure out for a long time is what is leading to these suicide deaths. We certainly know that about 90% of deaths are related to a history of depression. There are certainly other risk factors besides being male if you've had a history of suicide in your family. Previous suicide attempt is a risk factor. There's also things, you know, like Jerry mentioned, if someone's had a chronic health problem or a history of not only mental illness but maybe addiction, drug or alcohol abuse. And so there's factors that increase the risk of suicide, but there's no determinants to say and predictions on who will die of suicide and who will not.
Dale Chell with us, Youth Suicide Prevention Coordinator at the Iowa Department of Health. If you'd like to join our conversation, exchange listeners, we'd like to have you. Has suicide or attempted suicide touched your family? You can share your story, your thoughts on suicide prevention this hour, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Jerry Campbell, you lost your brother to suicide in 2007. You got involved in a group in Polk County called Coping After Suicide. Now, at what point did you find out about this group?
July of 2009.
Mm-hmm. And that was how long after Dusty's suicide, your brother's suicide?
Almost 2 years.
2 years. Nobody pointed to you? Did anybody point you to a support group that this might help, or did you just not think that was something for you?
I didn't think it was something. Well, I didn't know because once I joined the group, it's kind of like when you're out there in that void all by yourself, you think you're the only one in the entire universe that feels like that. Mm-hmm. And I decided that it was time for me to pick up the pieces and start not only recovering myself but trying to help other people. So I found the group, and the first time I was there, I felt this is leading right back to what Dale said. I was the only male in that group, and all the other ladies were there, and I was there all by myself, the only man. Mm-hmm. And we have people coming and going every month. I go on the group meets the second Thursday from 6 to 7:30 p.m. and the last Saturday from 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. at the old Target building on Euclid. So anyone that wants to come is more than welcome. And I want them to understand that you're not alone in your feelings and what's going on in your mind. And these people here are really going to try to help you as much as we possibly can.
Yeah, I'm amazed, Jerry, that you suffered with the loss of your brother to suicide for 2 years before joining this group. What was your life like before the suffering you had before joining this group, and what relief did the group bring you when you finally joined it?
Well, before this, I just kind of wandered around wondering if it was just my family and myself that had these feelings and thoughts. And then once I got into the group, it's the one thing that was immediately available is I'm not crazy, and all these people have maybe not the exact same feelings, but they have the same type of feeling and thoughts that I have. So mm-hmm. Feeling like this is normal after something like this.
So you have been in the group a while. What are typically the topics you'll discuss? Just listening to each other's stories?
That's all we do. It's all just people come and sit, and you want to talk, you can talk. If you want to listen, you can listen. If you want to talk about what happened, we'll sit and listen and comfort you. And we try to answer questions that people have about their feelings. And the nice thing about this is you're in a safe area, and everybody in that room is a suicide survivor, meaning they've had a suicide in their family, And the fact that, I don't know, it's an inanimate feeling that you're in a safe area with people that know what you've been through.
I imagine quite emotional experiences there.
Oh, we've had some tremendous emotional experiences. And that's really, you know, it's the old, from the line in A League of Their Own when the baseball manager is talking to the ladies and says, you know, there's no crying in baseball. It's a fact that men aren't supposed to cry in public. And to be able to sit in that room and cry is quite a relief.
And do you think that's why the way men are trying to hold in their emotions is why a lot of men don't show up in these groups?
Absolutely, because, you know, ever since we started playing Little League, you get hit with the baseball. Coach says, rub it off, you know, or walk it off. You were never allowed to cry as a little boy or anything all through sports and everything else. And, you know, I'm not trying to tell all the men what to do with their lives, but, you know, some of the women in the group talk about how their husbands or sons or brothers or something aren't opening up to them. And they need to open up to somebody because you can't keep those feelings pent up forever.
Okay, let's go to our first caller. Has suicide or attempted suicide touched your family? We're looking for people to tell stories to help raise awareness about suicide prevention. Share your story, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. From West Des Moines, Suzanne is joining us. Suzanne, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having a discussion on this topic. My 31-year-old sister committed suicide, but she died in the locked ward of the state mental facility in 2002. Mm-hmm. And so I've been an emergency department nurse for over 17 years. And my comment is, you know, if there is somebody, a family, that would have had the resources to prevent a suicide, it probably would have been mine. I'm a healthcare worker. You know, my sister had mental illness from the time she was a teenager on and off. She was bipolar. She had never verbalized an intent to harm herself and had never had a previous suicide attempt. And her psychiatrist at the state mental facility was really surprised about this outcome. But my, you know, to maybe help comfort your commentator, one thing I learned is that you know, with suicide, family members, we keep saying, well, we could have done more. We could have been more patient. We could have kept more contact. I used to say I could have written more letters to her when she was in the hospital. The year before she died, I took her out of the hospital against medical advice and tried to have her spend time in my area with my family. And she had some wonderful times in the few months before she hospitalized herself again. But she was extremely noncompliant with any medication and that offered to her. She would constantly alienate all her support systems from herself and refuse to use them and ended up back up in the hospital. And once you're in the state mental facility, there are very limited resources to be reevaluated frequently in that. So what my husband helped remind me is that he said when she was out of the hospital, when she was having a hard time and you kept trying to connect with her, you were almost going crazy in that. So he said you have to admit that you're a human being who have limitations, and you can only meet them on the level that you're able. So, you know, it's you know, when somebody dies in the situation she did, you would think that's the safest place for a person to be, and she managed to die anyway. So what helped me is she did leave a note that was very disturbed. She was getting forced Haldol injections and was sometimes delusional. But the detective that was on the scene helped me in saying, he said, well, you know, honey, this was probably just, you know, a momentary lapse in judgment. And once she did this act, she was unable to turn back. So it's just as if you have a teenager, you know, who made the wrong decision driving and was killed, or you had somebody else. Sometimes it's a momentary lapse in judgment, or it's like other illnesses. We have to realize that sometimes this is an unfortunate outcome in humanity, and we have to accept the fact that, you know, we're limited in what we can do for other people as human beings.
Suzanne, I'm very sorry for the loss of your sister. Thank you for sharing your story. I'm wondering, I want to ask Jerry Campbell this, who lost his brother as well. We're coming up to a break, so in a brief sort of way, Suzanne, what can you tell us about what our society, we here in Iowa, can do better about preventing suicide? What comes to mind? You have a medical background in an emergency room setting. What can we do better? What are the biggest points we can hit on here?
Well, I think the biggest point is just supporting our hotlines or our support systems. I have an older sister who is also bipolar, has had eating disorders throughout her life, and the one thing that has kept her alive, and she has, unlike my younger sister, frequently verbalized suicidal intentions, and the one thing that's good is that she's reminded to use the hotlines, and she does. When she feels that she, you know, and most suicidal people, it's not some, you know, depression is just not being able to see all the alternatives of what you're, you know, from the difference between being dead and your current state in life. So, you know, therapists and hotlines provide them with intervention that helps them see their other alternatives. So supporting the hotlines, embracing, you know, I think what your caller is doing great. I didn't even know there was a support system for family members. So that's helpful too, but just battling the social stigma, making resources available, and making people comfortable using the resources is great.
Suzanne, thank you for your call. Suzanne, joining us from West Des Moines. Jerry, we have a couple minutes before we have to take a break. Anything to add to what Suzanne said? You listen to her story. How can we prevent the vast number of suicides in this country, in this state?
I honestly don't think you can ever stop them. And because my brother could have made a phone call anytime he wanted within a certain amount of time after he started his injections. Some people, they just want to die. And I know it's not pleasant for me to say that, but it's the truth. I think what she said about getting more information out to the public, supporting the hotlines, and just trying to get people more aware of what's going on, because I don't think a lot of people in Iowa realize how many suicides, how many people die of suicide every year in this state or in nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more information we can get out, the better our chances are of slowing down the suicide rate.
Dale Chell of the Iowa Department of Public Health, what is your opinion here as we go into this break? Your keys to suicide prevention? Maybe you can mention, people have been talking about resources. Maybe you can mention some resources people can turn to if they have concerns about themselves or a loved one as we go into this break.
Well, the caller brought up a good point where there's the hotline resources are very, very important. And there's a number of local resources that I'm sure in the second half of the hour we'll talk more about in terms of specific communities who have their own hotlines. But there is a nationwide suicide prevention lifeline, 1-800-273-TALK. And these are mental health professionals who are trained in working with people who are not only suicidal but also family and friends who are maybe concerned about somebody and want to ask more questions and want to know about resources. So that's a very important resource to have.
We have to go to our break. Dale Chell will stay with us. Jerry Campbell, I want to thank you once again for telling us the story, and very sorry for the loss of your brother to suicide in 2007. Thank you for helping us raise awareness about suicide prevention, Jerry Campbell.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we'll continue with this program that looks at suicide prevention efforts in Iowa. Has suicide or attempted suicide touched your family? Share your story, your thoughts on suicide prevention, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. We'll be back in just a minute. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Great to have you with us for The Exchange over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. Time spent outdoors, both during school and at home, helps children become high-performance learners and score higher on standard tests. That's according to a new report by the National Wildlife Federation. Tomorrow on this program, we'll discuss the report and the consequences of American children spending only minutes a day playing and learning outdoors. Also, we'll learn about Taproot, a community program that puts children back in touch with nature. Today, we're talking about suicide prevention. Every day, approximately 90 Americans take their own life, 2,300 more every day attempt to do so. Over 34,000 people in the United States die by suicide every year. This hour, to mark National Suicide Prevention Week, we're looking at suicide prevention efforts in Iowa, and we've been talking with Dale Chell, Youth Suicide Prevention Coordinator at the Iowa Department of Public Health. If you'd like to join our Conversation Exchange listeners, we'd like to have you. Has suicide or attempted suicide touched your family? Share your story, your thoughts on suicide prevention, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. In addition to Dale Chell, we're now joined by John Sheehan. He is the Crisis Intervention Program Coordinator at the Johnson County Crisis Center. John, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
This is a fairly new program. The Johnson County Crisis Center started a suicide prevention coalition last year during National Suicide Week. It's 1 year old. Why was it formed?
Last year, we held a town meeting in September of 2009 to talk about the issue of suicide in our community in Johnson County. And really out of that town hall meeting, there was numerous people in attendance for community members, agencies, and we all came together and decided suicide was an important topic that wasn't being addressed as fully as it needed to be. Mm-hmm. From that meeting, we developed the Johnson County Suicide Prevention Coalition and established it actually in October of last year, so we're coming up on our one-year anniversary. And we really just wanted to incorporate local agencies, local community members, increase the education, the awareness, trying to get the issue of suicide and suicide prevention out into the community as much as possible.
So what – explain – help me understand the gap that you think this coalition is filling. What are you doing now that – in terms of services that weren't taking place before?
A lot of the issues that we're working on, our first year was our first year's goals were working on strengthening relationships between agencies, between individuals. And one of the things that we worked on is connecting local agencies with the people who could actually use them. So if someone is feeling suicidal, how do we actually get someone the help that they need? We've been working on education campaigns, awareness campaigns. Probably our most successful thing to date would be the Out of Darkness Walk that we held on the 22nd of August last month. It's a national program, but they have local walks where people come and support the cause. It's for suicide survivors, attempt survivors, people who have been touched by suicide to raise awareness, raise funding for the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention. And our walk, it was the first year. It went really, really well. We had over 160 people mm-hmm. in attendance, and we raised I think up to $16,000 now.
Fundraising and also mm-hmm. destigmatizing.
Most definitely. Most definitely.
Suicide prevention here. Okay, let's talk to Barb in Cambridge. Hi, Barb.
Hello.
Yes, good afternoon. Welcome to our program.
Yes. I had called to make sure that people knew about there is a Out of the Darkness Walk in Ankeny at the DMAC campus next Sunday, the 19th of September. And when you ask the question, what else can be done, you know, to help prevent suicide, that's definitely one. And another is to establish more support groups, because when my son John died of suicide in 2005, we looked around for quite a while, but there was only one group that we were able to find in the state, and that is the Polk County groups that was mentioned before. So they seem to be very, very, very few places groups for suicide survivors to go mm-hmm. for help.
Barb, I'm sorry about your loss. Tell us how the Out of Darkness Walk helps support you, helps you cope with the loss in your family.
Well, the walks, your previous caller that said they just had their first walk in the Iowa City area, first of all, I was really glad to hear that, because I was. It seemed like the one here in the Des Moines area was the only one going on for a few years here. But what it does is it makes you feel similar to what your guest said, that you're not alone. There's many, many, lots and lots, hundreds usually of other people there. There's speakers that talk about, you know, suicide, how to prevent, and so on. There's that you're contributing to the cause. If you can, you pull together a team, and there's a wonderful spirit of support and compassion, and it's a great way to draw strength. And then there's a wonderful ritual at the walks that we have here where we, you know, do things like let balloons go at the very end of the walk, kind of in a closing prayer service type thing. So, I mean, each individual walk can do their own thing, but it is just a tremendous sense of we are not alone. There are others out there to help and support us. And again, the stigma that you talk about is very real, and it does help to eliminate some of the stigma that is attached to suicide.
Barb, thank you very much for joining us and sharing your story.
You're welcome. But, you know, tell the folks that there is a direct correlation between the fact that few men attend suicide support groups and the fact that, as you said, 80-some percent of suicides are by men. It's because they're not talking.
Right. Dale Chell, can you back that up? Men tend to hold things in. That is more likely than not. If you talk about it, you're less likely to get in suicidal thoughts.
Well, I think there is some differences with gender in terms of willingness to open up, and clearly men are less likely to be honest about what's going on. So they're often the ones keeping those feelings in because they're perceived as weak, asking for help, and they're not going to do that. So certainly that seems to put them more at risk.
Has suicide or attempted suicide touched your family, Exchange listeners? We'd like you to share your story in the remainder of our hour, your stories, your thoughts on suicide prevention as we try to do our little part to destigmatize and raise awareness about suicide. 1-866-780-9100, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Jane is on the line from Hawkeye, which I believe is in northeast Iowa. Welcome to our program, Jane.
Hi. Yeah, we just buried one yesterday from a suicide. His brother committed suicide 5 years ago, and it so affected him that
Is this a family member, Jane?
Yes, my nephews.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, and then I've had an aunt, a cousin, and a good friend last year, and my son had a friend 3 years ago, and it's just become such almost an epidemic with the depression and pushing these people into feeling that there's no answer but this, and they don't realize how it hurts everybody else. If they could see the people that come to their funeral and how hurt they are, then that they didn't feel that they could do anything for them to stop this.
Jane, have you found support, you and your family members?
Some of them have gone to counseling, but they say, it's the stigma and keeping it to yourself and dealing with it inside your own family. Is very hard, you know, with the depression. People don't realize it, that it's almost a sickness that they can't get over.
Dale Chell, tell us, what are the statistics about suicides in families? Jane calls it an epidemic in her extended family.
Well, there certainly is a risk factor when you've had not only personally you've had a previous suicide attempt that puts you at higher risk, but also if you've had a family history where there's been suicides that have occurred. And clearly, if there's been a history of mental illness or addiction in the family, that puts you at higher risk to attempt suicide or die of suicide.
Jane, thank you very much for calling from Hawkeye.
Yes.
And again, our condolences.
Thank you very much.
1-866-780-9100. theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. John Sheehan, describe a typical call that comes in at the crisis center that may involve someone who is leaning towards suicide. And what's done when someone calls a suicide hotline?
When people call in and they are experiencing an emotional crisis, the volunteers that answer our crisis line are trained to do a lot of active listening, a lot of reflective listening. What we find most often when people are suicide's a really difficult topic to talk about. People in the community don't like to talk about it, but even the people who are feeling that way don't really like to talk about it. And what we do when we train our volunteers is to teach them to recognize the warning signs, pick up on feelings of hopelessness, pick up on feelings of helplessness and feeling like a burden on those around them. And when people call in and they talk to a volunteer, they open up about what is actually going on. They usually don't come right out and actually say, I'm feeling suicidal. But most people will say, I'm having a really hard time with this. I don't think I can keep going this way. And what the volunteers will actually do is pull out the reflection there and ask them directly, are you thinking of killing yourself? Mm-hmm. And that the ability to ask directly opens up a dialogue for someone who probably doesn't have a lot of avenues to talk about the true way they're feeling.
Now, in someone calling a typical crisis hotline can remain anonymous. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Definitely, definitely.
Definitely. So that should not be an inhibition to calling up. You can call up anonymously, talk with someone about your feelings, and get some guidance.
Most definitely.
And if it turns out to be in the normal range, then all the better, right?
Exactly. And if it's not, then you have someone, a trained individual who's dedicated and compassionate to talking to that specific person.
I wonder what is the normal range, Dale Chell? Is considering suicide, even if for a moment, as a fleeting thought, ever considered normal?
Oh, yes. I think many people have thought about suicide, and now you're talking degrees in terms of they may think about what's that like, how could people do that, just intellectually thinking about it to the point where they've been very depressed and wondered that that's a way out. So I think suicidal thoughts, again, to varying degrees, are within the normal range of what people experience.
Mm-hmm. So at what point should you be concerned about yourself or a loved one? Where is the line crossed when you say there needs to be some intervention, some support, some counseling?
Well, when you talk about warning signs, I think when people – we know that about 90% of people who die of suicide have a diagnosable mental illness that's probably untreated. And when they start to experience significant distress in their life that makes it unable for them to work, to have fun, to have relationships with other people – if they start to have experiences of depression where they're not interested in anything anymore, another, and John can speak to this too, a risk factor, a characteristic that's pretty can be alarming is the sense of hopelessness for the future, that things aren't going to change, that there's no way that they can get out of the situation that they think that they're in. And of course, when they start to withdraw and isolate themselves, and that increases those thoughts. So that's where people could, if they're concerned about themselves or others, recognize that if they can't help themselves, then those closest to them maybe can guide them and assist them in getting assistance.
Now, specifically to the point of students, according to the Burden of Injury Report by the University of Iowa Injury Prevention Research Center based at the University of Iowa College of Public Health, for college-aged young adults, 18 to 24, suicide is the third leading cause of death in the country, but the second leading cause of death in Iowa. John Sheehan, why are students, and students especially in Iowa, at such great risk of suicide?
College is a huge period of transition for people. They're moving out on their own. This is maybe the first time that they've actually been responsible for every aspect of their life. And what we find is more people begin to feel suicidal, especially college students around the May-April timeframe in spring. And that's true for the general public. But if we think about our community here in Iowa City, it's a huge period of transition where people are graduating, they're moving away for grad school, they're beginning to go out in the real world, and that can be incredibly burdensome and really overwhelming for a lot of people.
1-866-780-9100 to join our discussion. Leanne is joining us from Davenport. Good afternoon, Leanne. Has suicide touched your family?
Yes. My godfather committed suicide in 1984. And my mom, it was my mom's brother, and we were all very close. Like every couple of weekends a month, we'd all go boating, things like that, and our family fell apart. Mm-hmm. But it had the opposite effect on our family that it did the other woman's family. I feel so bad for her that so many people in her family have done that. But our family views that as such a selfish act that after seeing what happened to our family, that it would never happen again.
Has this caused your family, your extended family, to talk openly about suicide and really have the antenna raised for people who have some emotional distress in your family?
We don't talk about it, but we all participate in suicide walks.
What's that?
We all participate in different like suicide walks in the area.
Walks. Okay, I understood watch, but suicide walks. Yes, I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but our family, like I said, we still don't discuss it, and it took a long time for all of us to start getting back together again. And so now we're back to regularly a couple times a month, getting together again. So.
Mm-hmm. Your godfather committed suicide in what year?
1984.
Now, you've had a long time to deal with this and observe how our society has dealt with suicide and suicide prevention. Have you, Leanne, noticed any difference in the stigma attached with suicide? Are we doing better in the intervening decades about talking about it? these programs that you're hearing about on our program today?
No, we still don't. I was a social worker for 9 years, and it's just, it's like a dirty little secret. Like, you know, family skeletons, keep them in the closet, and like I said, our family still doesn't discuss it. We don't discuss how it literally affected our entire, every single one of us. His daughter was, there were, she was, the family was divorced, and she didn't start coming around our family again until she was probably 17 years old. So, and when it happened, she was six.
Mm-hmm. Leanne, thank you for sharing your story. Leanne from Davenport.
Thank you.
And let's go to another caller as our hour gets away from us. Linda is in Ames. Good afternoon, Linda.
Hello.
Yes. What's your story?
I lost my niece to suicide 3 years ago.
I'm so sorry.
And I guess my comment is that it is, even when somebody does need help, it is so, so hard to find professionals to work with. Especially in rural communities. She lived in a rural community, and trying to connect her to, you know, help was hard. But also, even for myself, I was trying to, you know, get help for myself, and I had to go to a different community to go and get that because it's just not there. I really think that if we actively want to help people, we have things just like how to do the Heimlich on our bulletin boards at work that maybe we need to start posting. Where to get help for depression, how the suicide line, so that our that we start helping people find a source so that it isn't in the closet. It's right there on the bulletin board. Gee, mm-hmm. I didn't, you know, I'm not feeling good today. I really feel hopeless, and here's something I can call. And I think that would be a good thing for Iowa to fund with for mental health. If they can't fund mental health like they used to, at least start finding, posting sources within counties.
Okay. Linda, thank you for your comment. I think John Sheehan wanted to react to something you said. John, yeah, we have a few minutes left.
Well, exactly just like Linda said, the one of the most important things we can do for suicide prevention is teach as many people as we can about the warning signs of suicide and what to actually do if a friend of theirs, if a loved one of theirs is exhibiting some of these warning signs. There's a nationally known program that, called QPR that stands for Question, Persuade, and Refer, and it's designed to teach the average person how to recognize suicidal warning signs and then what to actually do. And the QPR is one of the programs that we at the Crisis Center are working on here in Johnson County, trying to teach as many people about suicide prevention, where they can turn, what they can do, how to get help for themselves while getting help for their loved one at the same time.
Linda, thank you for your call from Ames. We have just a couple minutes left. I wanted to turn to Dale Chell and ask about schools, testing for vision and hearing. Do you think there should also be some sort of mandatory screenings for depression, warning signals that lead to suicide? Dale Chell?
No, I don't think they should be mandatory, but I think they should be offered to families of youth. And we do have some programs throughout Iowa called the Columbia University Teen Screen Program, which offers screening to families who are interested in having their youth screened for mental health problems. And then what it does is it detects those youth who have been, you know, untreated, undiagnosed, or under the radar, who seem like on the surface they're doing okay, but they're hurting inside, and then making the appropriate referrals for services.
Okay, we have.
I would like to add very quickly.
I want to let John in here very quickly. Quick comments, Dale.
I would encourage people to go to the AFSP.org website because they list the suicide support groups in Iowa. There's over 8 of them, and they can identify one in their community. And also to recognize that the suicide prevention walks are also throughout Iowa. There's one in Mason City, Cedar Rapids area coming up, and in northwest Iowa and Royal Iowa.
John Sheehan, we didn't get to talk much about the partnership between Johnson County and the University of Iowa. Quickly on that?
Quickly, we this week and next week especially, we are working on QPR sessions for student and faculty. There's one in the next 4 minutes, there will be one for faculty and staff at the University Services Building.
And this is a type of intervention.
This is a type of intervention, suicide prevention education program. For any students that are listening, the QPR will be held tonight from 6:30 to 8 in the Palmer Career Center.
Okay, very good. Throw out the contact information again very quickly, Dale Chell, before we go.
www.afsp.org.
Dale Chell, Youth Suicide Prevention Coordinator at the Iowa Department of Public Health, thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
John Sheehan, Crisis Intervention Program Coordinator at the Johnson County Crisis Center. What contact information would you like to leave us with?
The crisis line is the best way to call for anyone who needs us, 319-351-0140.
John Sheehan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dale Chell, thank you very much. And so many thanks to those who reached out to share their painful stories with us this hour as we mark National Suicide Prevention Week. The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer. Catherine Perkins, production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli, technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, we had help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.